Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We do not have a quorum yet, so in spite of Representative Johnson's timely being here on time, I should say, he's going to have to wait to do his work. But we're going to start in spite of that, get the ball rolling. And so our first agenda item is the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I just had a chance to meet Mr. Reichs. So please introduce yourself for the record. You might want to pull that microphone over in front of you a little better and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Reichs. I'm the Executive Director and CEO for the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I've been the CEO now for 8 months, replacing longtime CEO Jeff Hamill, who retired last May. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. Today I'm going to try to go through things very rapidly. I have about 20 slides, and I'll go ahead and get started. The MAC is a public corporation. It was created by the legislature back in, 1943. We own and operate the airports within 35 miles of downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis. There's obviously Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and a system of six general aviation reliever airports. We take a user fee approach in running our airports so that if you use the facility, whether you're an airline passenger or flying in on an aircraft or a business at the facility, you pay a user fee, and that helps us support continued development at the facility. And we do have limited taxing authority that was given to us by the legislature back in 1943, but we really have not used that since the 1960s, nor do we plan on using it in the future. We have 12 board members and a chair that are appointed by the governor, and four of those, or excuse me, eight of those represent districts in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Four are from greater Minnesota who serve, and currently those members represent Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, and Thief River Falls. They do serve four-year terms, which works well for us. They're staggered terms so that as the governor changes, we do not have a wholesale change in our board, and we like that approach because we have a lot of projects that extend over multiple years, and it's good to have that consistency in our board members. I'll focus on the top half of this slide. The MAC Commission is highlighted there in yellow. As you know, we report to the state legislature. We report to you. And we have three committees, a Finance and Administration Committee, a Planning, Development, and Environmental Committee, and a Management and Operations Committee. The structure works well. Items are vetted through those committees before they reach the full board, and then once they get to the full board, they come forward for a resolution. We have a 600-member staff. If you were to compare us to many of the other large major hub airports in the country, it's a very lean staff. We operate much like a city with our own police department, fire, dispatch capabilities, building inspection, planning and development, maintenance departments that take care of ensuring that the snow is plowed and the grass is mowed around the facility. Our staff is very dedicated. There's low turnover, and they're very passionate about what they do each and every day. In addition to our staff, we have about 20,000 employees directly tied to the Minneapolis-St. Paul operation, and those employees are obviously airline employees, TSA, FAA, concessionaires, and other business-related employees. Our mission is a global mission, connecting you to your world. Our vision is providing your best airport experience. And that mission and vision is focused around seven strategic goals. First and foremost, safety, security, and preparedness. Customer service is a very high expectation amongst our business out there at the airport. Air service development as well, to grow air service. Economic, we take a very conservative approach from a cost structure standpoint, and obviously a focus on maximizing the airport's economic benefit. engagement, working very strongly to continue to engage communities and integrate our airports in the surrounding communities. Innovation, technology, and sustainability are high priorities that we've been investing in significantly over the last few years. And talent, being a model, not only being a model employer, but ensuring that our workforce represents the community that we live and work in, not only our workforce, but when we look at our construction projects and concessions as well. The MAC airport system, as I mentioned, Minneapolis-St. Paul and six reliever airports. Minneapolis is the major hub airport. St. Paul is considered an intermediate airport, meaning that it has a runway in excess of 5,000 feet. It's able to handle large corporate aircraft, but really not able to handle a sustained commercial air service operation. We have Lake Elmo to the east. We have Anoka County Blaine Airport to the north, Crystal to the northwest, Flying Cloud to the southwest, and then Air Lake further south. Altogether, there's about 1,360 aircraft based amongst all of our airports. Over half of those aircraft are based at Flying Cloud and Anoka County Blaine Airport, so a couple of our busier airports. A little snapshot history of operations. Back in 2005 was our all-time record year when we had close to 1.1 million operations throughout our airport system. The Minneapolis operations are the bottom part of the graph. The reliever airport operations combined on the top half. That trend has continued a downward trend until just recently. Reasons for that trend, obviously, the recession, higher fuel costs during the recession, from a general aviation corporate flying standpoint, insurance costs really went up. From a Minneapolis standpoint, our operations have come down primarily for a couple of reasons. One, consolidation of the airline industry, less aircraft that the airlines are flying, and secondly, the phase out of the smaller turboprop and 50-seat aircraft. Delta alone had over 425 50-seat regional jets. That number is currently down to about 125. As I mentioned, we take a very conservative financial approach, really for two reasons. One, we operate this facility as a business. And secondly, and we really don't have any backstop. I mentioned we do have a tax levy, but we have no intentions of using that, and we really do our financial forecasting based on not ever having to use that tax subsidy. And secondly, we're accountable to our stakeholders. As you're aware, airlines are very focused on costs of operating at the facility, and we want to ensure that those costs are as low as they can be. Our financial model is really predicated on only our originating and destination traffic. And to give you an example, we've got about 55% of our traffic volume is from those people either starting their flight here in Minneapolis or ending their flight here in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. 45% are connecting passengers. When we plan financially and when we bond, we only we predicate that on just those origination and destination travelers. And the reason for that is if anything were ever to happen with the Delta hub, we want to ensure that financially we can still have a solid operation. We maintain a six-month reserve, and we have, I think, the highest bond rating in the country, a AA-minus bond rating, which there's only a handful of airports across the country that maintain that rating. I'm going to share a little bit about our costs, a little bit more detail. There's a metric in our industry called CPE. CPE stands for cost per enplaned passenger, and enplanement is a boarding. And you can see where we're rated. We're currently at about $6.53, and that's in the lower third when you compare our CPE to other airports in the country. And what's even more ironic is There's eight or nine airports above us with higher CPs that are located in the southern part of the country with no snow removal costs. Now, we maintain 450 pieces of snow removal equipment to ensure we can clean those runways very quickly and minimize any aircraft or airline delays. And so even when you factor those costs in, we maintain a very, very competitive rate. And that's important because when airlines are looking at enhancing or growing air service in a community, and if we are on, from a demand standpoint, equal standing with one of these other airports, they look closely at this CPE, and if we're lower, the chances of us gaining that service other than another airport is that much greater. When you look at our finances, our operating revenue is just over $315 million annually. Primarily four areas. Parking and ground transportation is about 37% of that. Airline rates and charges is about a third, or just over 30% of that. Other rents and fees, rents examples would be leases with the FAA, the TSA, the Customs and Border Protection, individuals that own hangars or operate businesses, that's about 14% of that number, or $49 million. And then concessions. We operate about 85 concessions between the two terminals, Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. Those concessions are food and beverage, retail, and various service concessions. And they generate about 11% or $39 million annually. Operating expenses of about $181 million. Personnel, about 46%. Maintenance, 21% of that. Operating services, 15%. Utilities, about 11%. And professional services, 4%. We have about $1.6 billion currently in debt service, and that debt service payment is just over $100 million annually. That results in about a $73 million surplus that really goes back in to support infrastructure and capital improvements at the facility or at our airport facilities. From a statistics standpoint, we're the 16th busiest airport in North America, 15th busiest in operations, landings and takeoffs, and we're Delta Airlines' second largest hub next to Atlanta. I had an opportunity to meet with the new Delta CEO who replaced Richard Anderson last May, Ed Bastian. And I'll tell you that Ed Bastian is very committed to the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport in the state of Minnesota. They refer to it as their second home. And one of the main reasons is because we have 17 Fortune 500 companies, one of the from a per capita, the highest per capita in the country, and they understand that business travel is very important to them. We've received a number of accolades. These are just received over the last year and a half, and we're focused again on maintaining our reputation as one of the nation's best airports. We receive concession awards, environmental awards. We're focused on sustainability. Fifth most affordable large U.S. airport based on really some advances in air service. And that one on the lower right, the America's Best Bathroom, we're very proud of. We actually received that this year, and that just isn't amongst airports. We were up against Coca-Cola in Atlanta and many other corporations, so we take that seriously. Just recently, you may have heard that we rated in the top five on highest on-time airport in the world. So that's really a testament to Delta and Sun Country and our personnel for all they do from a snow removal standpoint. Air service development, much progress since 2008. As I mentioned, we're Delta's second largest hub. Delta currently has 375 daily departures to 149 nonstop destinations. We've seen a lot of growth recently in Sun Country Airlines. They're up to 36 destinations now. Air Alaska entered the market in 2008. They're adding San Francisco service in June. Southwest, who entered in 2009, is now up to 13 destinations. Spirit, an ultra-low-cost carrier, has seen very rapid growth, now up to 16 destinations, and also some nice growth from international carriers such as Air France, Condor, and KLM, which will reinstitute Amsterdam service here very shortly. From an airports commission, we spend a lot of time and we invest resources in air service development. We have a very competitive incentives program, but that program cannot work without a lot of collaboration with agencies and groups like Greater MSP, our state chamber, our local area chambers, our destination marketing organizations. We work with DEED. We work with the state trade office as well to really focus on that international opportunities. Just a graphic of depicting 10 airlines added a total of 24 additional routes in 2016 and 2017. And I think more importantly, that second sentence, we now enjoy competitive air service, meaning more than one carrier operating on 53 of our 155 direct routes, and that certainly has pushed airfares in the right direction from a consumer standpoint. A little bit about passenger numbers. We thought we were going to hit an all-time record this year. We're going to end up, I think, about 80,000 passengers short of hitting that all-time record that was achieved in 2005 of 37.6 million passengers. You can see the down trend during the recession. We really roll with the economy, but we've seen some very nice steady growth over the last 5 to 6 years, growth of anywhere from 2 to 2.5 to 3%. We're projecting about 2 to 2.25% over the coming years. I want to highlight just a few improvements that you'll see as you're coming through the facility this year. The first one, that picture is really the front of the terminal. We're actually adding, in Terminal 1, I should say, we're adding 15 feet to the front of that building. And the reason for that is we're completely changing and improving the vertical separation or the vertical circulation elements in there, the escalators, the elevators. We're also completely refinishing the ticketing area and the baggage claim area. As you know, baggage claim has got low ceilings. It's kind of dark in there. We're raising the ceiling by a couple of feet, adding much lighter finishes and some natural light features to improve it. We're spending $43 million this year, but it's a phased five-year project, and it's going to end up being about $400 million when we're all said and done with it. The picture below that is the gray box is a new parking structure that we will start construction on in probably July or August of this year. It will accommodate 5,000 parking spaces, and that project will take a couple of years. We plan to open that in 2019. It's a $293 million project as well. And then the final project that you may have heard about is a new hotel. This is a tremendous addition to the airport campus. It will be a nice customer service amenity for those that want to fly in and have meetings on site or that are flying out early in the morning and want to get to the facility and relax. It will have its own skyway that will go over to Concourse C. And the MAC is paying for that skyway. It's about $17 million. The total project, which is being constructed by Graves Hospitality, is about $90 million. But again, a tremendous 300-room Intercontinental branded hotel will be a nice addition. We are preparing for the future. Our forecasts really identify about 50 million passengers that we will serve. If we continue to see the growth rate that we're anticipating out to 2035, to meet that demand, we will spend about $1.6 billion over the next 6 to 7 years on infrastructure and improvements at the facility, and about $2.5 billion when you look at our forecast horizon out to 2035. As you may know, airports are really economic engines in communities. They're a tremendous asset. This was a 2012 study indicating we generated about $10.1 billion in annual economic impact, about $611 million in tax revenues, $3 billion in employee earnings. When you look at any jobs that are touched by the airport, it is approaching 80,000 jobs. and there's about $1.9 billion in visitor spending brought in. So we are actually updating this study. It's getting old now, so we're going to be doing an update this year. I guess that's the extent of my presentation, and again, I appreciate the time and happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ritz, for being with us today and your presentation. Members, we are going to be rolling through these pretty quickly, so I would ask you to limit your questions. I have a couple three questions on the list. One request, Mr. Ricks, would be that you submit your presentation to our committee so we can put it up on our website if somebody wants to review it for some reason. We'd like to have that available. I would like to officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Johnson, you have a motion to make.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass the minutes from Tuesday, January 24.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed by the same sign. Minutes are approved. Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ricks, for your presentation and congratulations on your new position. The question really revolves around, first of all, before I start, every presentation I've heard over the years, it seems that the MAC has been very well managed and is proactive and so forth, and yet I see, according to one of your charts there, that your debt service is right around 30% of your revenue. Currently, I know the Department of Transportation is trying to keep their debt service at 20% or lower, and currently it is quite a bit lower than that. I was wondering if you could give us any comment about how you feel about the level of debt service you carry, what are the benefits and what are the drawbacks to that level of debt service?
Mr. Ricks.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. We look at that very very closely. I think our debt service all-time high was about $2.3 billion 10 or 12 years ago when we constructed the north-south runway. But again, going back to how we look at it from a conservative standpoint and the fact that we only base it on originating and destination traffic, we feel very, very comfortable that we're, and in fact, when you look at other airports of our size, major hub airports across the country, our ratio is a very comfortable ratio in that regard. So, I tell people, I think our finance team that we have is one of the best, if not the best, in the country. When you look at airport financing, they are very conservative, and we take that seriously, and we'll continue to do so. So, we're very comfortable with it.
Okay, just quick follow-up.
Sam Petersburg,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree, and I think you are very financially one. But it would seem, from my understanding, that there was a need for a certain level of debt in order to be able to accomplish the growth that you have, and that includes sometimes increasing your debt service. And so I was wondering if there was any benefit that you saw to that, and then I'm done.
Mr. Ricks.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think when you look at it, and I don't know if this is answering your question appropriately or not, but you, from an airport perspective, you want to stay ahead of the curve from an infrastructure development standpoint so you can accommodate additional demand and additional service. And a good example is we just built four new gates onto Terminal 2. And those gates were immediately occupied by Southwest to accommodate Southwest and Sun Country Airlines. So it's a careful ratio. You want to stay ahead of it so you can accommodate new service, but you don't want to overbuild so that your costs are increased. So I think that's really our approach to it.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Ricks.
Thank you.
I know this is not necessarily the jurisdiction of the MAC, but a number of my constituents about a little less than a year ago were very concerned about the TSA lines. And it seems like that's worked out, but is this a thing of the past? I mean, folks are missing their flights, and, can you give us a status update on that?
Mr. Ricks.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, and I think it's a good, it is a good story. I mean, obviously, when that North Checkpoint opened, I think there were a couple of issues. One, TSA transitioned slowly into it, and they transitioned into it during one of the highest demand periods over spring break. that could have been chosen. And thirdly, they frankly didn't have the staffing necessary to accommodate those lanes. Through a lot of interaction with Senator Klobuchar and Franken, the governor's office became involved in it. We were able to get additional TSA screeners here to remedy it. In addition, they instituted canine teams, which allowed individuals to bypass really the traditional security lane and then go into the pre-check lane so that screening could occur more rapidly. But I just had a, to answer your question, I just had a meeting with our federal security director yesterday, and he assured me the resources are there, they are prepared, and that this should not be an issue. Over Thanksgiving, I think our average wait times were about eight minutes, which is very, very acceptable.
That's encouraging.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to track the number of incoming passengers who use the transit system to get to their destination?
Mr. Rick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but I'm happy to get back to you. Mitch or Tom, do you know? Well, I'll get back to you with a response.
Well, if you could get that information to us, we'd appreciate it very much. Thank you for your presentation today. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Next up, we have the MnDOT Freight Advisory Committee.
I don't have a presentation, so I know...
Oh, well, it's been nice seeing you. We'll see you later.
Absolutely. I think the impact one pager was included in your...
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your non-presentation.
Chairman Torkelson, Ranking Member Hornstein, other members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to represent the Minnesota Freight Advisory Committee today as you continue discussing the state's freight transportation...
Excuse me, you didn't give us your name.
...needs and priorities. My name is Jason Craig.
Right.
And I voluntarily serve as one of nine individuals on the Executive Committee of MFAC. My day job is the Director of Government Affairs at C.H. Robinson, one of the nation's largest third-party logistics provider, proudly headquartered in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Our MFAC chair, Mr. Bill Goins from FedEx, sends his regrets. He's unable to present this testimony. You get me instead. All of us on this side of the table and the folks following me know how important our freight network is to the health of Minnesota's economy. Getting manufactured goods, raw materials, and crops to our customers near and far, and filling our Minnesota shelves and factory floors with efficiently produced food and inputs is what drives our freight transportation businesses. We share our roads, rails, waterways, and airports, however, with interests that are developed and maintained by our public officials, both elected and career. We all must communicate and work together to understand our current strengths, such as our medical device industry, and our weaknesses, such as our distance from the coast and shipping lanes, as a freight network, and make improvements when needed to compete regionally, nationally, and, of course, globally. This facilitation of information, expertise, and discussion is where MFAC plays our greatest role. For those of you who may not be aware of the Minnesota Freight Advisory Committee, we were established in 1998 as a multimodal, multi-regional, public and private committee to streamline information, communication, and coordination among all of Minnesota's freight stakeholders to improve our freight transportation network. The last federal highway bill required all states to establish freight advisory committees, and MFAC already serves that purpose and qualifies to fulfill this requirement. In 2015, MFAC leaders, with the support of MnDOT staff and Commissioner Zelli, expanded MFAC and moved forward with a formal restructuring of our membership base. We heavily recruited a broad section of Minnesota freight interests, including most of the other panelists here, to further establish MFAC as the primary resource for both public officials, MnDOT staff, and the private sector to communicate, collaborate, debate, and connect regarding our freight transportation needs. We meet quarterly and have laid the groundwork to be a primary resource for freight discussions statewide. We are now positioned to provide legislators and MnDOT staff with even more focused insight and granular information more quickly into how freight needs impact Minnesota's economic competitiveness. For example, did you know the state's diesel tax accounts for approximately 20% of the state's overall revenue raised for transportation? The MFAC one-pager that you have with the member roster gives you a sense of the broad membership of MFAC. I feel confident in saying that no other state has the advantage that Minnesota currently has with a healthy MFAC as a reliable resource for legislators who need to quickly identify experts in areas that may seem opaque at first to get your questions answered. If you need to know about how the changing oil and fracking economy has impacted Minnesota freight movement, we can identify experts for you. If you have questions regarding the difference in how diesel taxes or tolls are absorbed into freight rates, we can identify experts for you. If you have questions regarding how global trade impacts rural economies, we can identify experts for you. If you wonder how urban congestion impacts freight deliveries, we can identify experts for you. If you wonder how long it will be before autonomous trucking technology impacts Minnesota, we can identify experts for you. We understand that sometimes answers and input to questions like these have very short lead times, but you can count on MFAC to get the prompt answers and information you need. I'm confident that you and MnDOT staff can now use MFAC as a real-time, rapid-response resource for your committee as needed. In the near future, you can look forward to MFAC input and monitoring of the new Minnesota statewide freight plan and implementation of the plan's agenda of more than 30 action items. In addition, MFAC will have a role in providing input to MnDOT's new freight investment plan that will take advantage of the stable five-year funding stream provided for the FAST Act, averaging $20 million per year for our state. While federal money serves as a base for MnDOT, it needs to be complemented by significant state investment as well. Soon you will see MFAC's first annual report, and we've just begun developing a strategy for our first white paper focused on what factors contribute to a good and attractive freight market for Minnesota from various perspectives. While MFAC is involved in providing input and reviewing the state's transportation plan, there's a question we've been wrestling with that you can help us with. MFAC can respond to and provide opinions about legislative or MnDOT proposals presented to us, but should MFAC begin to generate and advocate policy recommendations ourselves? Would consensus priorities from MFAC be welcomed by your committee? We want to know how MFAC can be a better advisor for our elected officials so that Minnesota's freight network continues to support our businesses and consumers for years to come. With that, I'll conclude and open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Honestly, I don't see any questions. You did such a good job that we are fully informed. But thank you for being with us today, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
And we look forward to your questions, and we'll get back to you very quickly on them, we promise.
Very good. Next, the Minnesota Ports Association. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
I'm Deb DeLuca with the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I'm Director of Government and Environmental Affairs, and I'm trying to find my slideshow.
Could you lift the mic up a little bit?
Sorry. I'm going to say that again. Deborah DeLuca, Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Thank you. Director of Government and Environmental Affairs. Maybe this one. Nope. There you go. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Excellent. Thanks so much. All right, let me know if you can't hear me. Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for having me here today to discuss cargoes to the Port of Duluth Superior. I'd like to start with, let me see if I know how this works here. There we go. Is that really the best we can do? There we go. I'd like to start with the... It's not doing this. Okay. Just a minute. Let me get this right. Yeah. It's not my computer. This way?
No.
No?
It don't exist anymore because the Barn Bill.
All right. Well, I have a map here. Can't see it. But in this map, it shows you where we're located, and that's important. We are a bulk, a non-hazardous bulk commodities, natural resources port, and we always have been. Probably we're located exactly 400 miles east of the midpoint of the North American continent. And that's important because we're perfectly located to be a portal for goods and services out of the heartland of that continent, and that includes both Southern Canada and the Midwest. We're also located at the very start of the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway. We are the number one port on the Great Lakes by tonnage. We are and we are also, depending on the year, because it depends on our cargo volumes or our tonnages, we are anywhere from the number 19th to about 25th port by cargo volume or tonnage. We are also located only about a 15-day trip from, sorry, I'm laughing because it would be so much easier with the presentation up, only about a 15-day trip from Europe. It's about 7 days to the mouth of, the Atlantic, to the mouth of the St. Lawrence Seaway, I should say, and another 7 to 8 days to Europe. Our number one trading partner is Canada. About 30% of everything that passes through our port either originates from or goes to a Canadian port. And then after that, of course, Europe, including Northern Europe, but also Spain, Italy, and then the Mediterranean, North Africa. A comment on the natural resources commodities part. We are, the demand for those commodities is driven by global markets. So those don't follow nice sinusoidal waves or gradual linear up and downs. It's really very much jaggedy up and down, and it's a little unpredictable. But that's the great thing about our port infrastructure. It is flexible in order to accommodate both the ups and the downs. We have 20. We're a bi-state port and a bi-city port. We have 20 bulk terminals within our port, and then one break bulk terminal. And that break bulk terminal is the only publicly owned terminal in the port, and that is the Duluth Seaway Port Authority's terminal. We don't carry bulk goods. We carry break bulk stuff you can lift with a crane or a forklift. It's pieces you have to lift one at a time. Now I don't have my great but cargo. You want to talk about cargo through the port. 2016 was not a banner year for shipping through the Twin Ports or across the Great Lakes, period. Volumes of iron ore, coal, and limestone fell below five-year averages, and coal, in fact, hit its lowest point in 30 years. We had just under 31 million short tons. Our five-year average is 36 million short tons. There are several bright spots in that picture, and especially looking forward to 2017. First of all, the fourth quarter was much stronger than the first three. Grain was up nearly 20% for the year, as well as not just at our port but also through the seaway. During the last 2 months of the season, we saw a definite uptick in iron ore pellet shipments, and I should mention that our season is January to January, so we still have about four or five ships. They've been in, they've unloaded, but we don't have their data yet, so these are slightly projection numbers. But iron ore looked really good at the end of the year. We ended our season up actually 6.8% over last year, over 2015, and December's tonnage was 15.5% of the December tonnage in 2015. And why is that? we opened the 2016 year being pretty optimistic, or I should say guardedly optimistic about iron ore. And I'm looking over here, Kelsey Johnson with the Iron Mining Association is in the back, so she can correct me. But experts were saying that iron, that domestic steel and iron ore production should, you know, improve toward the end of the year. It was going to hit its bottom, stabilize, and then start to climb, and that's exactly what we saw. And that was greatly thanks to the imports of foreign steel having declined, which is, again, in turn due to the tariffs that were imposed on unfair trade practices. We still have some dump steel that's cycling out of inventory, and as that dump steel is cycling out, we expect steel prices to continue to improve as the iron ore production fills those inventory vacancies, or fills that inventory. And in fact, all of the Iron Range pellet facilities are going to be online as the shipping season starts in March of 2017. So that's exciting. And that's all talking about bulk. And now, without my pictures, I can't really show you our lovely cargo slides. So when I talk about cargo, our number one cargo through our port is iron ore. Followed by coal, and through about 14.9 short tons, million short tons this year in iron ore, 10.2 million short tons in coal. That coal comes from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. It's low sulfur coal. We also think that that's hit its bottom. There are many facilities still throughout the country that that burn coal. There's some that use especially low sulfur coal. Many of the more inefficient facilities have been taken off, off grid, powered down. And we expect that there will be some demand overseas. I explained the iron ore. Grain is doing well, and we kind of expect that to continue. And then the other category includes limestone. Limestone's been down again because it's used greatly in taconite production, and that we expect to come up with increased taconite production. As well, limestone, for those of you from southwest Minnesota, is also heavily used in the beet pulp production. It's used to, essentially beats the beets into pulp, and it's called sugar stone, and it's stored on a couple different docks in Duluth. So anyway, that's another important commodity from our area that gets shipped down. It benefits other parts of the state. So other also includes salt, limestone, cement, and then our general cargo. Nice picture. Commodities you can't see. Excuse me. Picture of the iron ore. Iron ore. I will take a moment to talk about our iron ore, the importance of the iron ore to the rest of the nation's economy. The Department of Homeland Security did a study that I want to say it was about a year ago now, that demonstrated that they were looking at what would happen if something happened to the Sioux locks, if there was a terrorist action that took out Polock, or what would that mean to the nation's economy? And their results were that there'd be a recession that was more severe than the 2008 recession. And a typical year the iron ore that comes through Minnesota is shipped through the Sioux down to and it stops at many different production many different ports, including Sault Ste. Marie, Detroit, the Indiana harbors, and then Conneaut, Ohio, and other places, Ashtabula, and it gets used in blast furnaces to produce high quality steel. It's used in the by the Detroit auto industry as well as for appliance manufacturing. In terms of grain, we are on the edge of a big catchment basin that stretches from eastern Montana over to really all the way over to into Minnesota. And our primary grains are red spring wheat, durum wheat, soybean, sugar beets, but also as well we see barley, oats, flax, rye, canola, peas, and sunflower seeds that all come through our port. The catchment area is shrinking a little bit just because of the demand or the improvement to facilities on the Pacific Northwest and also that sort of increase in shipment to Asian markets. The one thing about grain, although it's our fourth biggest commodity after limestone that goes through our port, it is our number one export. 80% of the grain that comes through our port is exported primarily to Europe. And 20% goes to domestic millers. Some of our top grain destinations, I won't list them all, but I will mention Italy. After Canada, it's our number one grain destination. If you buy a box of Berea pasta or some other Italian-produced pasta at your grocery store, chances are that wheat came through our port because the Italians love our high-quality durum wheat that comes through our port and the quality control there, gets shipped to Italy, made into pasta, and then shipped back and sold here. You can pick it up at Kowalski's or wherever you live when you're here in St. Paul, wherever you shop. So those are the bulk commodities, and obviously very important to the economy, not just of our state, but to the region. And then talking about bulk material, bulk goods that come through break bulk that comes through the Clear Public Marine Terminal, again, owned by the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I have a picture here. I do want to say thank you. We just completed an expansion of our facility. We rehabilitated a dock that right next door to ours. It's been 25 years in the waiting, but that dock completion triples, and that was done with, in part, Minnesota Ports Development Assistance Grant Program funds, about a $2.75 million grant, leveraged a $10 million Tiger grant, $4 million of our own dollars, and some contamination cleanup money for an $18 million project that finished on time and slightly under budget. And it's already at use. If you were there at our port today, you'd see two huge Lakers that are docked there for layup, one on each side of the dock. But that also tripled our outdoor storage space. So we now have 40 acres of outdoor storage space, and that's important because next year is going to be a huge year for wind. But it's also important because it frees up space elsewhere on our facility for some new rail-to-truck operations that we are working on. We also have indoor warehouse space of 400,000 square feet, and that's important. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our cargoes, but first I want to tell you about some of the services that we provide to industries in northern Minnesota, and particularly the paper industry. Paper industry, as you know, is in a global knife fight, right? Any advantage that they can get, cost advantage through either transportation logistics or raw material costs, is huge. So an example of the kind of service we provide is that Verso, right here, right in Duluth, right? They used to need kaolin and clay for bulk machine for their paper products. They used to have to get that kaolin and clay from a domestic source, Georgia. It sounds like not that bad, but they were captive to one rail carrier, and the price they couldn't budge the price, and it was too expensive. It was driving them, to be uncompetitive. So they worked with us, and our Lake Superior Warehousing is our agent that runs our dock. They worked with us and Lake Superior Warehousing to come up with a process. We now ship the kaolin and clay up from Brazil, comes to our dock. It goes right to our warehouse, and then in a sort of just-in-time delivery, we slurry that and deliver it in tanker truck over to Verso. They get about 5 to 7 tanker of those trucks a day, and they work 7 days a week. And Verso's had to close other facilities in the U.S., and we think it's this type of cost advantage that helps keep them open in Duluth. So we play a role in making them competitive. We also, our warehousing facilities are also important to the paper industry, and this is where the importance of truck and rail comes in, right? So this stuff never touches water. We store both raw materials and finished product for the paper industry. We have pulp that's stored there as raw materials, and then finished product. We have big paper rolls and OSB board. So for Blandin Paper and Verso, as an example, they use our facilities. Both of them are captive to one rail, so they had one price. Common wisdom is sort of that if you have two rail carriers, you earn a 30% price break. I don't know that three or four get you that much further, but we're served by four Class 1 railroads. So what they do is truck their stuff down to us. We rail it out because we have more competitive pricing. Again, this helps those two, and it also connects them to distribution across North America because they're connected to BNSF, CNCP, and the UP. So they, broader distribution network. We have a I mentioned wind cargo. We are the number one port on the Great Lakes for wind cargo. 50% of all wind products that come through the Great Lakes come through our port. They come from, those products are shipped from all over the world, and they get distributed to projects. And I had a really nice map here, all over the U.S. I'll mention some Minnesota projects. These are mostly wind farms, and all the products, all, you know, towers, the huge blades that are now getting to be over 200 feet long, the nacelles, they all come through our port. Excuse me. The Taconite Ridge Wind Energy Farm in Mountain Iron, Pipestone, Laverne, Worthington, Elm Creek, Trimont, Maurer County, those are all wind farm projects that came through our port. We've also seen domestic product go out the other way, and in fact there have been times when they've passed at our terminal. The production tax credit for wind energy was passed in December of 2015, too late to affect the 2016 season, but we are ramped up for 2017. We think, you know, this obviously, we're not exactly sure what will happen with this administration, but for right now, we are anticipating 2017, 2018, 2019 to be bigger than any of the wind years we've seen to date. And so that rehabilitated dock will be full of wind products again, blades waiting to go out. We also deal in dimensional freight. Again, nice pictures, but you can't see them. But the generator, we have the a couple of examples I would like to mention. Steel coils, a picture of how, you know, the closed loop system on the Great Lakes. So iron ore comes out of the Iron Range, goes by ship through our port out to Algoma, SR in Sault Ste. Marie. It's made into steel coil, and it gets shipped back to us for distribution across the Midwest, and that is used for metal fabrication and structural steel. So that's, you know, think about that. If you place a tariff on that Canadian steel, you're also affecting the iron ore that went into it. We have generators. Well, we basically service the manufacturing industry, the power generation industry, mining, you know, and so we have I have lots of pictures of examples, but you get the idea. Our distribution for break bulk and cargo goes really all over the U.S. And I have to make this point. I don't know if Jason's still here, but a port is not a port without road and rail, right? I mean, the connectivity is extremely important. As I mentioned, we're served by four Class 1 railroads. We're also served by excellent highway access. We like to say truckloads and trainloads make boatloads. But as I said, a lot of our cargo comes in and goes out without ever touching the water. So, you know, freight is expected to grow hugely throughout the upcoming 20 years, and so that connectivity is very important to keep that infrastructure in good shape. And thank you for your efforts toward that end. Truck traffic through our CLIR terminal alone has grown 400% over the last 10 years, and we expect that rate of increase to actually go up over the next 5 to 10 years. I can end there, except without the pictures, except is there one more thing I wanted to add? No, other than, as long as MnDOT's here, I want to say thank MnDOT put together a Fastlane grant application. In December, we're expecting to hear any month now, or sorry, within the next month. We were hoping to hear by the 20th. But it's focused on rebuilding the Twin Ports interchange. And if you've ever driven into Duluth, you know this interchange. It's the one with 24 bridges, blind merges, and a light in the middle of the on one of the bridges. It's a $120 million project. They're asking for $45 million. Fastlane is a freight grant program, and so this is a project that MnDOT wanted to redo for safety reasons, but they're also looking at the increased freight through our terminal and through the port, and that's the reason why they pursued this project. I think it's very competitive, and I'm hoping that we land it, and I want to say thanks to MnDOT for putting that together. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, and we would appreciate if you could submit your pictures and the entire presentation
I'll do that.
To our committee administrators, so those of us that would like to enhance your wonderful description can
look through those. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, do I leave that? Should I just leave this here? Do you want me to clean it up and send it to you? What's the best?
I have no idea.
Okay, I'll
talk to this guy.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
members, my name is Kevin Wally, and I represent the Minnesota Ports Association, and it includes Duluth, St. Paul, Red Wing, and Winona. And I'm just going to say a few words about the river ports because they're an important access point for Minnesota commodities to get the world and global or national and international markets. First, St. Paul Port Authority operates three active terminals, Barge Terminal 1, Red Rock Terminal, and Southport Terminal. They've seen their tonnage through the three terminals go up significantly, over 3 million tons in 2015 compared to about 2,500,000 tons in 2014. The major inbound commodities at St. Paul include aggregate, fertilizer, salt, cement, asphalt, and caustic soda. The major outbound commodities are grain primarily, with scrap iron and potash as secondary exports. One of the recent developments in St. Paul that's been very positive is the installation of a heavy lift capacity at the Southport Terminal. Having this increased lift capacity of 250 tons has opened up the Southport Terminal as an interim or final shipping destination for electric transmission or electric transformers, wind turbines, and large generators. These are shipments that now make St. Paul a final destination for a whole new set of commerce. Winona saw a very busy season in 2016. It's their busiest season in the past 10 years. They saw over 1,200 barges handled at the harbor. This represented an increase of over 400 barges over their 2015 level. The primary activity at Winona is the exportation of corn and soybeans. They also have now attracted an Illinois company to manufacture soil amendment pellets for application on farm fields. This has allowed for importation of gypsum, which is one of the primary components in the farm pellets. Most of the commodities that ship through Winona originate in southern Minnesota or southwest Wisconsin, and Winona is the third largest of the ports in the state behind Duluth and St. Paul. And Red Wing, very, very briefly, also exports grain, and it receives slag, which is used in a manufacturing process that's hosted in Red Wing. Their inbound tonnage at Red Wing was 9,600 tons, and their outbound tonnage was just under 600,000 tons in 2015. So our river ports are a very important part of the network for moving freight, and we just wanted to make sure that part of the story was highlighted as well for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Appreciate that. I have a question. What are soil amendment pellets?
They are gypsum and other materials that are pelletized for controlled release in the soil. So it's like fertilizer. It enhances the composition of the soils for the farm operations.
Hmm. You know, I'm a farmer by
chance. I know you are.
And I hate to have to ask a question about something related to farming, but
I'll get you some more information about
I'd appreciate
company.
That. Yeah. My soil may need to be amended itself. Representative Johnson apparently has some information for
thank
us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my wife's a darn good gardener, and we use gypsum to lighten up our thick soil in Lower North Mankato.
I see. Do you use pelletized soil amendment products?
He does it with a Volkswagen. Sorry, I didn't go through the chair. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I do not see any other questions. I'd like to thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hauser.
Mr. Chair, my question is probably for you or somebody from southern Minnesota, but does the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail eventually connect to either Winona or Red Wing Port? Does anyone know that's just been developing to move more commodities?
No, it does not. It goes from the Twin Cities, and we're headed west from there.
And I just got a quick answer here, too.
DM&E
connects to the
Winona. Representative
Rundman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose this is a bit of a random question, but I think, Mr. Wally, that there are several other ports in Minnesota, yeah. One being Roseville, and I'm just interested in, is that a definition in statute as to, I imagine it's trucking, but Could you just describe what those ports are?
The port authorities that you find in Roseville and Bloomington, I think Granite Falls has a port authority, that is the choice that the community has made for their economic development work within the community. Under Chapter 469, you have housing and redevelopment authorities, economic development authorities, and port authorities. And there's a whole set of economic development authorities and structures that are provided for in 469. And so there are cities who have adopted that form of government, if you will, for their economic development activity, but they don't actually have a port per se. So it's a choice of form for their economic development work.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That stimulates a question for me about the facilities in Savage that receive grain and up on the river.
Yeah. Mr. Wally.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the distinction there is that those are privately owned terminals, and the benefit that they would get from some of the state programs, for example, is on the Minnesota River, there have been some grants that have been provided for the dredge spoil storage areas along the shoreline in some recent years. But otherwise, the port activity is managed by private companies rather than by a public authority.
Mr. Wally, I have one final question for you. When can I board a Viking cruise ship and go to New Orleans?
I think the issue there, both St. Paul and Red Wing are interested in providing facilities to accommodate that. The issue that is slowing the decision-making about the establishment of that service is the requirement, it's a federal requirement, that the boats themselves that would provide that service must be constructed in the United States. And so they're trying to figure out where that would be done. And so there's a federal law requirement that is slowing the process to some extent. And I don't know the exact status of that legal issue.
When you mentioned federal, I got optimistic, but when you mentioned that the problem was manufacturing in the United States, I got somewhat pessimistic. Representative Nelson.
Sounds like Representative Rukavina has been involved.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have the Minnesota Trucking Association. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation. I do believe we have a handout from the Trucking Association for members. It's already in your packets.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I should say three handouts.
I also have a PowerPoint that we're trying to queue up here. So while staff's doing that, I'll introduce myself. My name is John Houselodden. I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and it's great to be in front of your committee today. And we really do appreciate the opportunity to talk a bit about our industry. You do have in front of you three handouts. There's a fact sheet about the industry, a one-pager, Minnesota Fast Facts. There is a trucking safety fact sheet that's put together by our national organization. And then I do have a printout of my PowerPoint in front of you with all the slides. So as staff is working to get this, I don't know, is it that one right there? I emailed it. So
we don't have it. That's good.
We'll go off of the paper.
We have copies, so please.
All right. And I know there are copies out side for the public as well. So the Minnesota Trucking Association is a statewide trade association that represents about 675 trucking companies and their allied members across the state. And what I'm here to talk about today is how the Minnesota trucking industry is essential, it's safe, and it is responsible. Trucking really is Minnesota. If you think about it, what we haul is a microcosm of Minnesota's diversity. You know, we haul raw ag products, raw timber products, raw minerals from the soil, and they become things. Manufactured cabinets and snowmobiles. And we haul the really big things, the wind generators and the fins. We heard those talked about. And then the really small things like, you know, catheters and pacemakers. We haul all of that. And so the equipment that we use to haul it reflects what we're hauling. So if you look at your handout there, if you're hauling a wind generator, it's a heavy specialized vehicle, many axles with permit. You're hauling a tank, you're going to have tank, Christmas time, you're going to get a lot of parcel deliveries at your home in a small van. So the equipment that we use represents that. And you see all kinds of other equipment that reflects that diversity of the state. And we also like to say on the next slide that if you got it, the truck brought it. There's a game I play, and I can't do it in a legislative hearing, but we could do a little test to say, name something in this room that didn't spend some time on a truck or was affected by a truck. But, Mr. Chair, I know you won't allow that, so we'll move on. But it's really true. Trucking is the link that brings all of these diverse elements of Minnesota together. And there's a lot of businesses out there. There's just under 18,000 Minnesota-based trucking businesses that have interstate authority. There are many others that just travel in the state. And 68% of Minnesota communities are served exclusively by truck. So think about that. Rail, water, air serve a critical role. Intermodal operations critical, but there are many communities where trucking is everything that goes in and out. So they're highly dependent on trucking. And you're going to see different statistics. The ones that I share show that trucking hauls about 78% of all Minnesota manufactured tons. This chart is national, so it only shows 70%, but you're going to see all kinds of charts. But in the end, two-thirds to three-quarters of all the manufactured tons travels on truck. So trucking is essential, and again, if you got it, you do believe a truck brought it. Next slide. These are really also, in many cases, small businesses on wheels. Many truck drivers are employees of companies. Many truck drivers are independent contractors. That truck cab is literally their office on wheels, and they take on all the risk and all the debt to build that business. And what's exciting about it is they can have that business anywhere. But the entry cost today, it's getting quite amazing. So 2017, we call that the power unit or the tractor, $150,000. That's with the sleeper berth. That's not all chromed out with all a bunch of extra stuff. That would be your considered over-the-road tractor that's going to be serviceable. And then if you're going to have a high-tech trailer that can meet the most stringent environmental emission standards, you're going to put air diverters, you're going to put wings on there, you're maybe going to have double-wide tires on the back, less rolling resistance, $60,000. So you're all in for a brand-new tractor trailer just starting is over $200,000. It's a sizable investment. So again, if you're an independent contractor in this industry, you're all in. And it is really a small business on wheels. But we like to pay our fair share. We know we use the roads. We know it's important. So if you take the state and federal contribution, a typical five-axle semi-tractor trailer pays over $15,000 in state and federal taxes. Fuel taxes, heavy vehicle use tax, special tire tax, federal fuel tax. That's a lot. That's per tractor trailer out there. Next slide. They're good-paying jobs. I want to introduce you to my neighbor, Chuck. This Chuck Monson lives down my road on my cul-de-sac, dirt cul-de-sac. He's a truck driver. He likes what he's retiring now, but he's had a great career. He's raised his family, and he was able to live out in Corcoran, Minnesota, drive all across the country. And he is one of almost 35,000 truck drivers in Minnesota. And if you take the truck driving and all the other warehousing and back office and dispatch, we provide about 1 in 18 of all the private sector jobs in the state in the trucking industry in some manner. So that's very significant. And you can see from the Bureau, from the Federal Bureau of Jobs right now, the average salary is $42,490. That number is a little low. It's been growing up. You can see some advertisements for truckers getting paid twice that, depending on the kind of operation and where they're hauling. As you can imagine, the more sophisticated the freight, the more specialized, you get paid more. So think about this. You can have your own business on wheels, live anywhere in Minnesota you want, and make a great income. It really can be part of the American dream. So they're very good paying jobs. The next slide, of course, relates to safety. We are essential, we've established that, but we're safe. But I think the thing I want to stress is safety is not a priority for trucking. Let that sink in. Safety is a core value. Priorities change. But when you're in trucking, you have to have safety as a priority. First of all, it's the right thing to do. You know, you look at a truck and you think of, oh, it's just a hunk of metal and, you know, rubber going down the road. But these are men and women working hard. And when they look at us and the cars around them, they're not just seeing cars, but they're going, well, that could be someone's son or daughter or wife or father. And so there's all kinds of behaviors truck drivers take all the time to make the road safe. So they know it's the right thing to do to be safe, but it's also the smart thing. If a truck is not moving, it's not what? Sorry, Mr. Chair, that was a breach of protocol. They're not making money. That's right. So if you have a small crash or a big crash or anything in between, that's not a good deal. It's not good for people. It's not good for business. And so they want to keep that going. And we are a very highly regulated industry. We're like airplane pilots, if you think about it. So a truck driver has daily work limits, can be on duty a total of 14 hours, and when you get to 14, you stop. Wherever you are, you must be done. You can drive up to 11. Well, it's hard to get 11 hours driving in. And then you unload and unload. So you have limits, and it's tracked in a log. This is an electronic logging device on the picture here. And as of December of this year, every truck driver who is required to log will be required to use an electronic logging device. Drivers have to have physicals. You have to be physically qualified to drive trucks. You go through a physical exam that's specific. And if you don't meet the qualifications, the doctor can ask you to get an assessment for something else or get specified treatment, so not just anyone can. You have to have a commercial driver's license. And if you're going to haul certain things, like hazardous materials, you have to get a special endorsement. If you're going to haul tanks, special endorsement. So there's a rigorous approach. Drug and alcohol testing. Every person who has a commercial driver's license is subject to random drug and alcohol testing. And the good news is it works. The incidence of drug and alcohol use among professional truck drivers is very, very low. They're subject to background checks and, of course, continuing education. Because if you're a trucking company, you're always bringing your team in to talk about the latest issues, the latest challenges. What are we seeing? What are we doing wrong? Continuous improvement is important. Next slide, technology. Talk about an industry where technology has exploded. We've already talked about the electronic logging devices. Well, they're now they're connected through real-time satellite tracking. You can go into most trucking companies today. They can tell you where every one of their trucks is. They can pull up a map, show you real time, tell you if they've made the delivery or not, how far away, how many hours they have left for that day to deliver. Load planning, very sophisticated. There's a lot of cost to this, but very, very sophisticated. We have trucking companies putting cameras in the truck to track driver behavior and putting cameras on the outside of the truck in case there's a crash. Is it something we did or is it something the car did to us? In fact, when cars and trucks collide, in two-thirds to three-quarters of the cases, it's the car running into the truck. So these technologies and cameras help us to identify that. It's an optional device. We have technology now in trucks that can tell us if we're leaving our lane, an alarm will go off. It can start applying the brakes if we're following too close. It can start applying the brakes if we're going around a curve too fast. Again, all options, all extra money, but we see a lot of companies investing in these. But all of these things are really driver-assist technology. Just like cruise control is driver-assist for each of us. All of these technologies are on this continuum of moving towards what we call autonomous trucks. The picture you have here is delivery of beer. I've learned in the legislature, anytime you talk about beer and use an example, you get everybody's attention. This was a delivery made from Fort Collins to Denver in October of this year with a driverless truck. Autonomous. There was actually a driver in the passenger seat, but using aftermarket technology applied to an existing truck. So this wasn't a fantasy truck or a beta truck. It was an existing truck, off-the-shelf technology that a company called Otto, O-T-T-O, has put out there. So the technology is there. And yes, they didn't spill any beer along the way.
Darn.
Moving along, crash rate is dropping. We're doing it safely. In 1975, the federal government started tracking fatal crash rates, and it's dropped 73% nationally since then because of all kinds of things, partnerships. We work hard as an industry with the driver's education schools. In fact, in Minnesota statutes, the legislature passed a mandate requiring both class and laboratory experience on how to share the road with trucks. That was legislation that we advanced that is helping make the road safer. But one of the best things we love to do is to get students into trucks. We love to do these share the road programs where we bring out a tractor, a trailer, we park cars in all the blind spots, we bring the kids in, we shut the door, we have them look in the mirror. You know what happens? Those vehicles magically disappear. And all of a sudden they have this tremendous respect for what those blind spots are. And you can safely share the road with the truck by avoiding the blind spots. Don't cut a truck off. Don't tailgate. and that's a whole other presentation. But we do that with the students. Many of you have been in trucks at our facilities. We love to do that. We always work with the committee, and we'll do more. And just so you know that we do partner with the State Patrol. They instruct at our programs. They partner with us at our meetings and also with MnDOT. We have good relations with them. Move to the next slide. We also are, we said, safe, essential, safe, and also environmentally responsible. This chart shows the drop in particulate matter in NOx. If we go out to University Avenue and Rice Street 30 years ago, and if a truck was starting from a dead stop and we looked at the stack, what would we see?
Black.
Same brand new truck today, if you look at trucks starting from a dead stop, you would see nothing. Because of these changes in the engine and the aftermarket technology and many of the things the industry has done. Now, these will come at a cost, but the good news is we've dropped those two elements by 98% since 1975. There are voluntary programs like the SmartWay Transport Partnership that rewards carriers for reducing emissions, and then there's the new engine technology. And so the industry's made quite a change. Moving on to the last two slides, what are the challenges? Well, the economy has been sluggish. I'm in a series of regional meetings. I've completed 5 of 7. And when I talk to our members, they say 2016 was a hard year. And some of them compared to how hard it has been since 2008. They were profitable, but they had to be very lean. They had to work very hard. They said their teams felt really tired at the end of the year. So there's some sluggishness because we haul things. So when stuff is made into things, those are technical terms, right? Stuff made into things, we haul things. And when it's not being made, freight volumes go down. There is a weariness about over-regulation. Most of the regulations that drive trucking are done at a federal level. They're adopted by reference by the legislature. But there's a lot, and we've gone through a number of them today. Probably our biggest issue facing us is a driver shortage. It doesn't seem as big this exact day because, well, the economy is sluggish, and we're finding drivers. But we have a demographic problem. We are not backfilling the pipeline like so many industries, and as the economy takes off stronger, a bigger issue. Congestion is an issue. You may have noticed the American Transportation Research Institute just released their top 100 bottlenecks report just yesterday. And Minnesota has 4 of the top 100 bottlenecks, freight bottlenecks in the country. And there are the obvious ones. I-35 at 94 is the 45th in the country. I-35 at 494 is 55th. I-35 at 694 is number 71. And, of course, the east side won't be denied at number 88, I-35E at 94. Top 100 freight bottlenecks in the whole country. So what do truckers need in conclusion? Well, we need good roads and bridges. We're willing to pay for it. The transportation bill is critical. So we do urge the legislature, and we appreciate this committee's role. We stand ready to help you do that, do our part. We do think it's time, and we think the resources are there. We need consistent regulations, whether it's fuel or labor standards or anything else. We go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and for us, predictability is critical for pricing so we can deliver it, negotiate with our customers, reasonably price, and get it to you the best we can. Of course, just fair taxes. We're businesses, so all the things you do to all businesses affect us as well. And most trucking companies are still small businesses, family-owned, subchapter S, and so that income flows down, and so those are real issues. And then lastly, we need help having a qualified workforce. You can't drive interstate until you're 21, so there's really no good school-to-work path, and insurance companies require 2 years of experience after that, so we get a lot of people coming back to trucking after they've started another career. But as I've said, Minnesota's trucking industry, it is essential, it is safe, it's responsible. And we really appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to give that overview to the committee today.
Thank you, Mr. Hausladen. We have a few questions, starting with Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hausman. Thanks for the presentation. My question is about, can you walk us through the process to get licensed for a commercial driver's license here in the state of Minnesota? What kind of verifications are required? Is it solely Minnesota regulations that do this, or are there some federal verifications and such that are required?
Right. So basically right now, driver's licenses are still a state function. If you get a commercial driver's license in one state, that's good for all states. There is not a minimum training requirement right now before you take that test. But there is a proposal out in the federal docket for new entry-level driver training requirements, and they're receiving comments on that right now. So you essentially have to be able to demonstrate the skill, take the driving test, pass the back, you know, the query that the department does, and then you get your license, which is a whole different story than from what the company does to qualify you to bring you on.
A follow-up, Representative Cosby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there isn't much of a federal requirement in terms of licensing them?
Not Mr. today, but, Mr. Chair, there is a new proposal, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Next I have Representative Salk.
Mr. Chairman, this presentation is focused on...
Representative Salk, I'm going to ask you to use your microphone.
Sorry.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. This report is really framed on the state of the industry.
Right.
Very much so. One of the biggest challenges for almost every element of this, the safety, the equipment, and all of that, is legacy stuff. So can you give me some sense of what is our progress toward the legacy, both the equipment and operations, that need to find their way through time and or development?
Mr. Hausbach.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A representative. Trucking companies today typically are on a fleet turnover cycle, so 3 to 5 years is typically common. So you buy a vehicle, and within 3 to 5 years, you'll be trading that out for a new one. So that's the trucking equipment itself. The technology equipment, you'll buy the electronic log devices. You know, those are probably also going to be a 5 to 8 year turnover.
Representative Salk.
Just one more thing then. What about the private side, the non-corporate trucking that's going on? Because there's a fair amount of that. I think most of us know it, whether it's the farmer who's running all his own grain through it. It's all still, from the consumer's point of view, there's still trucks on the road. And so I'm curious about that rolling stock getting updated, and do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Hausladen, Representative Salk is asking about my truck now. So, you just be a little bit more careful how you answer this particular question.
Mr. Chair, let me think about that answer. So private is a broad definition, because if you haul, like your food service company, that's a private carrier. So we have many private carriers. And fundamentally, in the eyes of the law, unless you have a specific exemption, and there are some exemptions for certain segments of the industry, and agriculture has some exemptions, you're treated just like any other trucking company. So I would just say for-hire trucking companies have those dedicated turn cycles. Equipment obviously wears out. Every company has to decide what's their best. But, you know, fundamentally, a truck is a truck, and our organization believes they need to be operated safely. They need to comply with all the regulations, regardless of who owns them.
Thank you, Mr. Hausland. I'd just add a little bit to that, Representative Salk. You know, I'm a farmer. I do own a truck. It happens to be a 1989 International, so it doesn't have all the modern equipment that's been talked about here today, but it's also only 2 miles from my farm to the elevator, and that truck probably gets a couple thousand miles a year. It does, however, have over 500,000 miles on it, so somebody else used it a lot before it got to my farm. Next, I have Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hausladen, we have, over the years, one of the things that the trucking industry and environmentalists and others have been working on is in the area of biodiesel. And I was just curious if your industry has any comment or concerns or thoughts about our current biodiesel program and how that's working for you.
Sure. Thank you,
Mr. Hausladen.
Chair. Thank you. So right now, there is a mandate in the state that requires all biodiesel sold to include 5%, all diesel to include a 5% biodiesel in the cold months and 10% in the summer. And when the mandate was first rolled out, we did have some issues. And our members did take a lot of action to try and address those, adding tank heaters, inline heaters, additives, more number one blended with the fuel. And so what I can say is it seems operationally it is now working. I mean, we have anecdotal reports from members who say they still think they have some biodiesel issues. But recently, when we went to our membership and asked, is it a problem? Do you have data? Do you have samples? We didn't get a lot that we could come back and say there's a big problem. There could still be regional and pocket issues. So right now, our position on the whole issue of the mandate is we're just silent. It is what it is.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions. The first, you've kind of probably partially answered regarding congestion in the metro area. Can you give us some indication of maybe just like one trucking company, what it means to come through the metro area and deal with the congestion that we have, and maybe compare it to some of the other metro areas?
Mr. Hausmann.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. What I can tell you is trucking companies, by and large, avoid metro areas during commute times if they can at all help it, because every urban center has the same dynamic. It's just how long you will wait. I can't give you a dollar amount for wait time. Those calculations have been done. But what I can tell you is companies do build that into their pricing. Frankly, from a trucking perspective, predictive travel time is probably the biggest factor, because if it's slow but predictable, then you can monetize it. If it's variable, that's the big challenge. So we would love for less congestion, but predictable congestion is actually easier to work with. But you basically get as close as you can to your delivery or drop-off point before the next day, and that's why we have an issue with truck parking. There isn't enough truck parking out there because of some of these issues with urban congestion.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. The second question has to do with the driver shortage. And we know that many of our younger people now are not driving the way they used to. Is that part of the reason for the driver shortage, or is it other things as well?
Mr. Hausmann.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, it has been a cultural shift. When we speak to motor carriers, they can say once upon a time the farms and the experience that people had driving heavy equipment and trucks was just a great place to bring people in to become truck drivers. And certainly the military has been, but there's a less natural pool of just people in driving, you know, in the driving demographic. So that's part of it. And frankly, the trucking job is a great paying job, and for the people with that DNA, it's perfect. But, you know, you're away from home. It's demanding. Depending on what you're hauling, you might be tarping, you might be unloading. And so there's a lot of people who are not interested in that type of work. So we have to still move the stuff, but we have those challenges with a younger workforce that is not as interested.
Thank you. Representative Hausman has the last question. We are running out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Mr. Hausman really likes that slide titled, If You Got It, A Truck Brought It. And so I couldn't resist asking him a question about that, and that is, do you think drones will ever be competition for you?
Mr. Hausman.
I think the drones are going to have to be delivered to the store, the manufacturing facility, so we'll probably still have a piece of it. But a package, small package delivery for that segment, they're demonstrating it can be done. And interestingly, Amazon is looking at getting into developing their own fleet and discontinuing relationships with common carriers, so they're going to become a direct competitor.
I don't worry about drones carrying my corn to market. So, with that, Ms. Hausmann, we're finished with you, and we have one final presentation from the Minnesota Regional Rail Association. We'll see if they can make technology work. What are we doing up
front? To have a commercial driver's license, if you have a commercial driver's license, your blood alcohol is half.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Appis, please identify yourself for the record, and if you're ready, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appis. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. I want to say for the new, if I may, Mr. Chairman, for the new folks here, John Hausladen is a difficult act to follow. So I'm going to do my best, and I'm hopefully, there you go. I got some pictures to go with it. See? I armed myself with some pictures. Thank you very much. Let's see if that's what we want. That is indeed. I want to bring you greetings from Mark Wagner. A number of you know Mark Wagner. He's the president of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, as well as the Twin Cities and Western Railroad, which is a short line railroad operating in the middle of the state, essentially, operating out by Glencoe and out to Hanley Falls. Earlier, somebody asked about the Minnesota Valley Regional Railroad. TC&W operates that railroad as well. It's owned by five counties that are in the railroad business. As a matter of fact, it's the only publicly owned railroad in the state of Minnesota. All other railroads are privately owned. The Minnesota Regional Railroads Association represents all the railroads here, although there are individuals who will come to your doorstep on occasion and visit with you. I want to just give a quick shout-out, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to Brian Sweeney, who's back up here, who's been with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad for 32 years. Am I right? 35 years. I'm sorry, 35 years. He'll be retiring shortly, and Lydia Borg will be taking over his spot. I'll leave it at that. You decide for yourself, okay? And
I'm not sure what I'm supposed to decide, Mr. Evans. I've decided that they both look like fine individuals.
Thank
and
you.
I've been happy to deal with the old one, and I look forward to dealing with the new one.
Very good. And, Mr. Chairman, we've been before this committee quite a bit in the last 3 years. We've had lots of conversations, so we appreciate the 15 minutes we get here to try to cover a lot about railroads and be back and do an overview for you all. Let's see. There it is. Freight railroads in Minnesota. I like to say and characterize, and others have picked up on this, that Minnesota is a rail-rich state. There are 7 major railroads in the United States across the North American continent. 4 of them operate in Minnesota: the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Union Pacific, the Canadian Pacific, and CN, used to be the Canadian National. There are also about 18 short lines that operate in the state of Minnesota as well. The short lines are small little branch lines, if you will, that operate over shorter pieces of territory. And the short lines, in many instances, were spin-offs from the larger railroads when the railroad industry was deregulated back in the 1980s. They serve various customers. You can kind of think of them as the wholesale railroads, the big ones, the class ones, and the retail, the mom-and-pop railroads that operate on Main Street. There are 2 major, there's about 4,500 miles of track in Minnesota. That's the 8th largest in the United States. We originate we're number 4 in terms of the amount of product that's originated here and about in the United States, and about 6th in terms of the amount of product that comes into the state of Minnesota. Quick aside, regular rail car, 286,000 pound rail car, carries about what 3.5 truck trailers carry, and we like to say we can haul a ton of commodity 435 miles on 1 gallon of gas. It's a fuel efficient way to move things. If you want to see the first train that ever progressed across Minnesota, the one that went from St. Paul to St. Anthony, then you want to go up to Duluth, and you'll see the William J. Crooks. There's a little picture of it down in the corner over here, the William J. Crooks, in the History Museum, or the Railroad Museum up in Duluth. You want to hear about the economic impact of railroads. You want to hear about the state of the industry, the state of the railroad industry. Let me give you a quick little bit of context. Railroads, as you can see, have profoundly affected and profoundly shaped the history of the state of Minnesota and the Midwest as well. By the 1960s, railroads were essentially the highways that everything in this state was moving on. Unfortunately, at that point in time, there was a lot of government regulation of the railroads, and for all practical purposes, the railroads were essentially bankrupt. In 1980, the Congress had to make a decision: do we nationalize the railroad industry? Is it that important, or do we deregulate it? The decision was made to deregulate the railroad industry, and there was a rationalization, there was a consolidation that took place. We went from about 8,000 miles, 9,000 miles of track down to the 4,500 that I just showed you a couple of minutes ago. But in that process, through that constriction, there still is a great deal of impact that the state of Minnesota, that the railroads have in the state of Minnesota. You see here a reference to freight rail and ordinary industry makes Minnesota's economy extraordinary, done by a gentleman out in the University of Oregon. And he concluded that given what these railroads move, when you put that grain on your truck, Mr. Chairman, you take it to the elevator, and the elevator eventually gets it to the railroad, and the railroad eventually gets it to the ports, and we get it someplace else, out west or out across the country. About 7% of Minnesota's employment is somehow or another affected by railroads. It's about 250,000 people. About $40 billion of Minnesota's gross national product is somehow touched by a railroad, and we pay about $7 billion in one form or another of taxes here in Minnesota. The real estate taxes in Minnesota alone paid by Minnesota's railroads are about $50 million. And just so you know, that's collected by the state,
state keeps some of it, and then it's distributed back out to the communities and the counties that we operate in. Railroads haul just about everything you can think of. Just as trucks bring stuff to you, the railroads do as well. Think about this for a minute. When you turn the lights on this morning, you probably had coal that generated the electricity that that powered your shaver or powered your mixer or whatever it might be, turned on your lights. When you got in the car to come to the office this morning, you were driving in a car that was probably delivered on a flatbed that came to Minnesota. You ate something? We all ate something today. That food got to you in one fashion or another on a rail car. And your TV, your computer, your chemicals to purify the water that we all drink, all that arrived on railroads in one fashion or another. About a quarter of the freight that moves in Minnesota moves on the railroad. That's a 2012 statistic. It's a bit less today, just given the economic situation. But as I said, there's a lot that originates and terminates in Minnesota. The number that we have, the most current number, goes back a few years, is about 250 million tons of freight move over the system. That's about 4 million carloads. And every now and again, you meet us at a crossing, and you get to sit for a while while we haul that stuff one place to another. Less economic activity has produced less of that over the last few years, and I'll go into that in just a minute. But the estimate is that by 2040, that's going to be 250 times more rail activity. There's going to be more folks. There's going to be more economy. You're going to see a lot more stuff moving by rail across the state. This is a chart that you go, oh, great, another chart. That's what I needed was another chart. What I wanted to show you was the very end of the chart, the right-hand side. You can see over the last year the amount of freight, or the last, 50 months, the amount of freight that's gone through nationally and moving on railroads. You get to the end of this and you see what's happening with the economy. Railroads are an indicator, I like to say a forward indicator of the economy. And the amount of rail traffic, the amount of activity is down by, in some instances, as much as 30%. I was talking to Mr. Wagner yesterday, and I said, what's happened to your railroad? And he said about 30% of his revenues have just basically vanished because we're not moving stuff right now. You can understand what that does to any industry and what it does to the economy. So if you got something you need to have hauled, once you haul it on John's trucks, bring it to the railroad because we've got plenty of capacity. There are about 400 locomotives that are idled right now, sitting in various places in the United States. They're about $200 million a copy. Mr. Sweeney at his railroad has a number of those. He's got enough locomotives to run from here down to Hastings back to back, just sitting still. So there's capacity that has been generated, capacity that's been developed. Let me give you a little sense as well. I just want to do a brief little commercial because I think this can be useful to you all in working with your constituents. There are about 4,500 railroad employees. That's a smaller number than there used to be. And there's about 15,000 railroad retirees. They live in communities all over the state of Minnesota. And so we have an investment in those communities. Each of the railroads here has some form of charitable organization that it promotes. The Burlington Northern, Union Pacific, CPCN, each have foundations. And I just want to reference the fact that Union Pacific, over the last decade, has put about $500,000 into organizations like Save the Northfield Depot, the Neighborhood House here in South St. Paul, Habitat for Humanity, down in Mankato, where they run through Mankato Faith in Action. Burlington Northern itself has put about $1 million into the state of Minnesota, contributions it's made. And what we typically do is make contributions to entities in the communities that we run through. So if we happen to run through your backyard, there's a likelihood that organizations that you might have an interest in or might come to you for help and support could make application to these foundations. And you just go online and you look up Burlington Northern Foundation, UP Foundation, whatever it might be. Food banks, food shelves, a whole variety of different situations. The other thing that's kind of fun, some of you will be here at Christmas, hopefully not all of you, you might see the CP Christmas train that comes through every year, pulls through St. Paul, and has
all lit up, and they have a concert and stuff. I'm sure Representative Hausman and others may have seen it on occasion. And what they do is they raise money for the local food bank, as well as foodstuffs that are contributed. It's about $12 million they've raised since they've been doing it over the last 16 years, and about 4 million tons of food have been delivered. 4 million pounds of food have been delivered in one fashion or another. So, obviously, this is a commercial, but one of the things that concerns you most is how safe are the railroads?
Mr. Appetz.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
We are...
How close are we?
We're not tremendously close. We're getting fairly close. We do have the Department of Public Safety coming in next Thursday, I believe it is.
Okay.
I'm wondering if we could do the safety part of your presentation as part of that. I know that you're here on a fairly regular basis, and so I don't feel like I'm putting you into too much of a difficult situation. But I do see you have a slide about legislative issues near the end of your presentation. I think maybe it'd be good if you went through that today, rather than and then save the safety presentation for another time. Is that okay by you?
Guidance, Mr. Chair. Insightful thoughts on your part. As I mentioned, railroads, very quickly, I'll do this in 2 minutes, pay a fair amount of taxes to the state of Minnesota. One of the things that the Congress did back in 1976 was create the 4-Hour Act to try to revitalize the rail industry. And what it did was say that if you treat certain businesses one way, you can't treat railroads differently. In Minnesota, we do not tax the personal property of businesses. The governor's brought forth the proposal again this year, just Monday we were alerted to it, of an attempt to impose a personal property tax on railroads. This has been litigated several times in the state of Minnesota. It will be litigated again if it becomes law. I'm here to say that that is a very, very big concern to us. We pay about $50 million right now. We probably pay that an equivalent portion for personal property taxes if that actually were to be upheld. There's a grade crossing fee tax. We reference it as $33 million a year for the next 10 years to try to fix up grade crossings. Understand that grade crossings are crossings across railroad tracks as opposed to railroad tracks crossing over streets. And there are formulas for how these are fixed up. There are divisions of the cost. The proposal that was presented or that may come in front of you suggests that the railroads should pay the entire cost of fixing up all the grade crossings on two major corridors here in Minnesota to prevent derailments. The fact of the matter is less than 1% of the derailments that take place on crossing or take place on crossings. What we did to try to avoid that was improve the infrastructure, the track, the ballast, etc. Another issue I just want to bring to your attention are railroad police. For many years, we have attempted to have the police forces that railroads themselves have certified so that they could act like peace officers in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is one of two states, Wyoming being the other one, that does not allow for the certification or does not allow for railroad police to act as peace officers. We'll come and visit with you about this. We've had a conversation with several people about this and would like to have that discussion. There's also a piece of legislation that didn't get passed last year. Not for lack of labor on the part of your staff here, Mr. Chairman, or yourself, Mr. Chairman, in your earlier capacity as the bonding chair, you tried to put a piece of information sharing legislation in place with the first responders and emergency managers. And there was no transportation bill, didn't go in there, so we put it in a bonding bill that moved forward. And I guess we all know what happened to the bonding bill. So we would hopefully bring that forward. We've got agreement on that, and I think it's a very good piece of legislation. I, Mr. Chairman, have run out of time, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. We have time for a couple of quick questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall each of the last 2 years there was part of the conversation regarding rail was the number of oil tankers that were on the railroads, and I just wanted to see if you could briefly comment on, not only from a safety issue, so we can hold off on the safety piece, but just from a capacity issue. I do realize that there was a large number on the, taking up capacity on the rail, so comment on that, please.
Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, that has dropped dramatically. I would say... We went from 9 nine trains a week, I think it was, eight, down to about three. I think it's down to about three now. So it's about less than half of what was moving before on each of the two railroads, CP and BN, that were moving oil. It's just, I mean, there's a lot less production going on up there. If the pipelines are approved, there'll probably be a fair amount less as well.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein has the final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rapids. So on the we were describing with the bonding bill and the legislation, are you talking about what we passed in a very rare moment of bipartisan unity at a quarter to 12 on the last night here on the House floor? Is it that language or is it something else?
Mr. Rapids.
Mr. Chairman, it was that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, it was that language.
Okay.
Representative Hornstein, and I think it was a bill that originated on your desk.
Yes.
We worked on it a little bit.
Yes.
Yes.
So I just want to make sure there were a few different proposals floating around the last day, so I wanted to make sure that that was the one that you were referring to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rapids. We'll be seeing you again next week. Members, I have two quick things I want to take care of. First, I would like our page to come forward. I've been meaning to introduce him, or have him introduce himself, actually, for a number of meetings now, and I keep forgetting, but today we're going to do it. So, Sean, if you could just give us a little bit about yourself, that would be great.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sean Rival. I'm a 2014 graduate of St. John's University. I will talk to any Tommies, just not willingly. This is my second year paging. This is my second year with the Transportation Committee, so a lot of familiar faces in the room, and if you ever need anything, let me know. I'm more than happy to help.
Very wise of you, Sean, not to say anything about Gusties, so I appreciate
they're
that.
They're okay.
Finally, welcome aboard. Sean's been doing a great job. We're glad to have him. Finally, members, next Tuesday's meeting is not an official meeting. It's an unofficial meeting, but we are going to the Department of Transportation during our regular time. We'll be meeting in their, I believe, fourth floor meeting room, and the details of that will be available on the website, but it will be during our regular meeting time, and I think we have to go through some kind of security to get up there, so you might want to get there a little bit early. Members, with that, we are adjourned.